I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Yasser Arafat, president of the Palestinian Authority and chairman of the PLO, was buried today in Ramallah in the West Bank in the bullet-riddled compound where he spent the last years of his life. In Washington, D.C., Prime Minister Tony Blair and U.S. President George Bush met and spoke about the need to breathe new life into peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians. And President Bush remained firm in his belief that peace can only come after there is Palestinian democracy.
There's going to be people around who say, the Palestinians can't develop a democracy. It's impossible for them to live in a free society. I strongly disagree with that. And so the whole premise of this strategy that we'll outline is all based toward that vision of a free and truly democratic society emerging.
Well, to talk about the Middle East and the aftermath of the funeral of Yasser Arafat, we're joined first from Ramallah by Ken Ellingwood. He's correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And Ken, you were at that funeral today. From here, it looked completely chaotic. Can you describe it for us?
Well, I think it's a pretty accurate term for what occurred this afternoon. The Palestinian leaders who put this funeral together on fairly short notice did not have in mind what occurred this afternoon. They had prepared a special burial site lined in stone and marble. They had a red carpet ready to greet the two helicopters that were arriving with Arafat's body and Palestinian leaders who were supposed to, who were accompanying the body. What happened instead was that as soon as the helicopters landed, tens of thousands of people who had gathered inside the compound and out surged forward, overwhelmed the security forces who tried to hold them back, and it made it nearly impossible to escort the casket to the burial site. It took almost an hour for the officials just to get the casket to the site itself.
We saw pictures of maybe two guards on the casket and hundreds of people trying to literally pull their guns out of their hands. It looked really dangerous.
Yeah, one of the soundtrack of the funeral ceremony this afternoon was the sound of automatic weapons fire. There was almost a constant cracking of gunfire, both from the security guards who were trying to warn back the crowd, and from young masked militants who were kind of hanging around the edges of the gathering and firing their rifles in the air in their grief. So it all added up to a very noisy, very chaotic, and at points a rather frightening tableau.
Well, and we should say that Yasser Arafat was finally buried, but before that, apparently Palestinian television asked that radical groups not show up with guns and hoods, some of the radical militants, but they did. What was their effect?
Well, their effect was to just add to the sense of chaos. There had been a warning that if militants showed up with weapons, they would be arrested. That did not happen. I saw groups of militants ambling through the streets around the compound, firing their weapons in the air openly and doing so freely, and they were unbothered by the authorities.
There were also, as you said,
for them, it was just enough.
I'm sorry, there were also, as you said, some young youths chanting, they saying Arafat was poisoned, they were going to seek revenge. At one point, a Palestinian official came out and spoke to them. What did he say?
Well, he was telling them to stop. This is not the image that that the Palestinian leadership wants the world to see. The leaders of the PLO and the Palestinian Authority have taken great pains during this entire episode over the past 2 weeks of Arafat's declining health and then death to project an image of a transition of power that was orderly and dignified. And they were certainly hoping to project that same image today. I'm not sure that they were so pleased with what happened today, though Yasser Arafat, if he had been alive, may have been happy.
Is this a clash of an old Palestinian culture and a new Palestinian culture? Or was it just the heat of the moment or that there wasn't enough security? What do you make of what happened today?
Well, there's a lot of genuine grief around the death of Yasser Arafat. He was, for Palestinians, old and young, the symbol of their aspirations for statehood. I have been talking to Palestinians of all ages and stripes in the past number of days, and they continuously use the word father to describe him, a father figure, a leader, a teacher, and terms like that. This leaves them really at a loss and in included with the grief of having lost the symbol of their cause, they're also very, very nervous. And wary about the future without them.
Right. And some were telling us, though, in the days leading up to today, in fact, we heard a report yesterday from one of your colleagues saying that, you know, the reaction to his death was rather muted. People were kind of looking forward to moving on. He was also considered a roadblock in the roadmap to peace. So who was represented in this group? Was that the entire Palestinian thinking in the group that turned out today?
Yeah, I think both things are true. The reaction had, in fact, been muted in recent days, and today was the first day that we really saw it come out in force. A lot of the people who were there today were young men. We're talking about men in their 20s. There weren't many women there. There weren't many older folks there, in part because it was difficult for many people to get to Ramallah from other parts of the West Bank due to Israeli checkpoints and roadblocks. And so many people just simply stayed away. So what you ended up with here was a self-selected group, in a sense. These are people who admire Arafat, are fervent believers. And this was a genuine outpouring of emotion. There were a lot of young men who were just weeping openly seemed really at a loss. Mm.
Ken Ellingwood, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke to us from Ramallah on the West Bank. Ken, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And now we're going to turn to Aman Jordan for Christopher Dickey. He's Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine. And Christopher, I know you watched on television. I'm wondering, first of all, did much of the Arab world watch the funeral and burial?
I think everybody was watching it, certainly. I think people were fascinated by the spectacle, first in Cairo and then in Ramallah, and they were, I think, sort of surprised and not surprised at what happened in Ramallah.
Well, tell us, you know, from the Jordan vantage point, a country with a Palestinian population and a history with Arafat. So, how is the story resonating there?
Well, I think what you have to understand about really almost all the Arab world, and certainly the Arab leaders who showed up at the funeral in Cairo, is that they were not there for the man. The man was not that popular anymore in the Arab world, probably not even in Palestine. But the symbol that he represented was and remains enormous. So when you saw all those, King Abdullah of Jordan, but also Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, and almost every other Arab leader walking behind that gun carriage today, it was a real spectacle of support for the Palestinian cause, not a group of people who were particularly bereaved by the sense of personal loss because Arafat was gone.
And also disliked by many of them.
Oh, terribly disliked. I mean, you mentioned Jordan. I mean, there was a war here in Jordan in 1970 because basically Arafat tried to create a state within a state here, and King Hussein moved against him to stop that. It's known as Black September, a very bloody confrontation. And then Arafat went to Lebanon, and he tried to create a state within a state there. And that led to the Lebanese Civil War that lasted for a decade and a half. Mm. So everybody remembers that in this part of the world.
We were wondering yesterday, Christopher, if Shimon Peres might go. They shared a Peace Prize. Did he show up?
Not to my knowledge. In fact, when he was interviewed yesterday and today, he said that he was not going to go and didn't plan to go early this morning, and I don't believe he did. In fact, the word was that there was no official Israeli delegation, and of course, as you know, the U.S. delegation was very low-ranking. In fact, what you could see is the importance of the Palestinian cause was sort of measured by the seniority of the delegation. So everybody from the Saudis to the Moroccans sent very senior people, their leaders. Europe sent their foreign ministers, and the United States sent an assistant secretary of state.
Do we get any more insight into the future of the Palestinian leadership today? I mean, we know that one of the Palestinian leaders at the funeral is Farouk Kaddoumi. He's not been central for a while. Can you remind us a little bit about who he is?
He's a rejectionist. He never endorsed the Oslo agreements. He refused to go to the occupied territories as long as there were Israelis there. And he is seen as one of the last senior hardliners. But he has emerged in the last couple of weeks as also one of the more credible older leaders with the Palestinian population. What you have to remember about Abu Mazen and Abu Ala and these other people who are being touted now as the new peacemaking leadership of the Palestinians is that they have very, very little credibility among the Palestinians, partly because they're seen as collaborating with Israel and the United States, but partly because of their own alleged corruption. Kadoumi has remained aloof and distant in Tunis all this time. So by dint of that fact and the fact that he founded Fatah and the PLO with Yasser Arafat, he is gathering some credibility.
Right. Well, we want to ask you about some of the questions that have been raised. What happened to all the money that Yasser Arafat was said to have amassed? The relationship of his wife to the new Palestinian leaders. In fact, let's just touch on that quickly, because you have some insight into what went on between Arafat's wife, Suha, and various officials. Can you just tell us briefly about that?
Well, I think there's a lot of rumors that have been spread, malicious rumors that have been spread on all sides there. What I know from talking to people who are close to Suha and to the leadership is that there was just a huge emotional moment as Yasser Arafat was steadily deteriorating in Paris. People couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. Suha, who has no other real benefactor, was in a kind of a panic. And at one point, the infighting between her and the new leadership got so bitter that they were threatening to keep her from going back to her home in Tunisia and possibly to keep her from seeing her child again. That kind of thing, that's the kind of emotional pitch that existed. And it was as a result of that, partly, that she had that famous outburst on Monday where she said, these people are coming to bury him alive.
And her 9-year-old daughter with Yasser Arafat was at the funeral today, a rare appearance. But tell us, the money, millions of dollars, where is it?
Good question. Arafat never trusted anybody completely. He used money to buy loyalty. There was a guy who literally followed him around with a suitcase full of hundreds of thousands of dollars to hand out to people to buy them at any given moment. And his bank accounts, his investments all over the Arab world and Africa and Europe were spread out under not only behind false company names, but behind the identities of people that you would only casually know. Some people think Suha is one of those identities that was used to spread money around. It's more likely that it was Mohammed Rashid, an Iraqi Kurd who was the business manager for Arafat for a long time. He certainly knows where a lot of the money is. But there's almost inevitably going to be many accounts that nobody but Arafat could trace. And the amount of money we're looking at is probably about $1 billion.
Well, Christopher, we just have less than a minute left, but in closing, I just want to ask you to touch on and probably dismiss a rumor that's been flying around on the Internet and talk radio, a rumor that Yasser Arafat died of AIDS.
Well, as I say, there are a lot of malicious rumors floating around. A lot of times people die of conditions that doctors really don't know the cause of. They know the symptoms. They know that he died of a brain hemorrhage. They don't know what the cause was. Was it AIDS? No, there's no reason to think that, not on the basis of anybody I've talked to.
Okay.
Let's
leave it at that.
Poisoning is equally probable.
Let's leave it at that. Christopher Dickey, Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek, speaking from Amman, Jordan. Christopher, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The island nation of Madagascar, off the coast of Africa, hosts a staggering diversity of life. It's the only place in the world to hear the call of the ring-tailed lemur. In fact, Madagascar is the only place where you can find lemurs in the wild. And besides that, it has a multitude of flora and fauna, 200 kinds of frogs, 1,000 different kinds of orchids, a paradise. But some of those species may be in danger from human encroachment. Science journalist Dan Grossman has been to Madagascar. He's going back to report on the biodiversity there, and he joins us in the studio before he leaves. Hi, Dan.
Hi there.
First of all, the ring-tailed lemur, what do they look like again?
Well, there are 50 different species of lemur, so I'd have to describe a variety of different different-looking animals. The ring-tailed lemur, which I saw in the south of Madagascar, is very lanky looking. It is one of the lemurs that spends the most time on the ground. It goes bouncing around on the ground. It has a long tail that sticks straight up, which, as its name suggests, is striped.
Well, you've just answered one question. For those who don't know whether a lemur is a bird or a cat or a monkey, it is a...
Yes, it is a primate. And in fact, it's our oldest primate ancestor.
Mm-hmm. And we understand that Madagascar wildlife is called Malagasy wildlife. Mm-hmm. Why is it so special?
Well, Madagascar was originally part of a huge continent in the southern hemisphere that included Africa, South America, Australia, and what's now India. And about 160 million years ago, part of Madagascar and Antarctica and the Indian subcontinent broke off from Africa. And then later on, Madagascar broke off from what was left. And it's been sitting out there far from any other place for about 80 or 90 million years.
Mm, wow.
And so it's been isolated for a long time. So its species have had a chance to develop sort of along different lines than anywhere else in the world.
And we understand now that it's the size of France, but it has so many living things on it, it could be considered an eighth continent.
That's right.
What's it like to be there? I mean, do you bump into all of these things, or do you have to go search for them? How prominent are they?
Well, I was there in the dry season before, and in the dry season, a lot of animals are hibernating. The lemurs aren't hibernating, but a lot of the other animals that live there, like chameleons and geckos, are hibernating, and so you can't see them. And so what I've been told is that when it rains, as one person described it, there's literally an orgy of life. He said the frogs come out and mate. So when I was there the last time, which was in July and August, I didn't see a huge amount of wildlife. I did see some lemurs, though, and I saw some interesting birds. I didn't see many reptiles. I expect to see a lot this time.
Tell me more about what happens when it rains. I mean, the frogs mating and chameleons, spiders, what?
Yeah, everything you can imagine. Well, I mean, and everything that eats those things, too. The bats are around. One thing that I've heard about, and I'm a little bit trepidatious about, is that the leeches come out when the rain comes. And Madagascar and other areas around the Indian Ocean have terrestrial leeches. In North America, the leeches we have are aquatic. And so you would go swimming in a pond, you might get a leech. But in Madagascar, if you're walking through the rainforest, you can get covered with leeches.
Oh, great. It's like it was uber tick. Well, what are the people like there?
The original colonizers of Madagascar actually came from Indonesia, not from Africa, as you would imagine. And so they're... and then later on, Africans came and added to the mixture of people that you find there.
We understand much of the country is still living the way people did, you know, a couple hundred years ago. People first came there a couple thousand years ago, but now there's parts that have no radio, television, electricity. They use ox carts for transportation, and they've also had to cut down a lot of the forests just to live, to cook and to live. How is that affecting the wildlife?
Well, Madagascar has lost 90% of its forests since humans arrived there about 2,300 years ago. And actually, most of that cutting has been in the last 40 or 50 years. It's accelerated. So there's only about 10% of the forests left, which, as you can imagine, is a serious problem for the wildlife. The wildlife lives in the forests. In places where the forests have been cut down, you know, there's not that much wildlife there. The president of Madagascar announced a year ago that he was going to triple the amount of protected land in the country. And so that should make a big difference. And people in the conservation community are very excited about that. The problem is, how do you do that? I mean, you can designate something a park, but how do you really protect land? And that's one of the things I'm interested in, one of the reasons why I'm going. Because, as you say, people cut the forest mostly because they need the wood or they want the land, and they have to take the trees down in order to use the land to grow things. And so the challenge is, how can you provide people a living in a way that doesn't require more forest to be cut?
Science journalist Dan Grossman heading back to Madagascar, and I know you're going to be filing reports and information for our website so that listeners can tune into what you're doing. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we leave you with some of the sounds of the children of Madagascar. Dan brought us back from his last trip. And next time on Here and Now, the famously tolerant Society of the Netherlands is reeling from attacks on churches and mosques following the murder of a controversial anti-Muslim filmmaker. And the children who fled the early days of Castro's revolution in Cuba are called Pedro Pans. A young Boston playwright tells their story. That's next week. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Reviewing our top story today, Yasser Arafat was buried in his compound in Ramallah after a crowd of Palestinians broke through security and flooded the grounds in a chaotic and dangerous display of grief. President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair appeared together later at the White House, saying they would support a Palestinian state, but ultimately peace in the region is in the hands of the Palestinians. Well, now for a check-in in Israel. We're joined by John Ward Anderson, Washington Post correspondent in Jerusalem. And John, what was the reaction in Israel to the funeral and the service in Cairo? Were Israelis watching as well on television?
Yes, a lot of them were watching it on television, and I'm afraid that I wasn't with many of them, so I don't know what the reaction was, but I can tell you that it was an absolutely extraordinary sight. I've never seen anything quite like it. I've been to a lot of these Palestinian funerals of Sheikh Yassin and Abdulaziz Rantizi Abu Shanab, the Hamas guys who were killed down in Gaza, and I thought those were pretty incredible scenes, but this one was utterly amazing. The outpouring of emotion and the surge of the crowd when the helicopters came down and their commandeering of the casket was just an amazing sight.
How do you think it's going to be received in Israel?
Well, I think probably they're gonna recognize that the Palestinian people are very emotional, and that this was the leader, the father of their national movement, and I think that they're just gonna recognize that as being apropos of how the Palestinians feel about Yasser Arafat.
Given the height of emotion, what are Israeli officials telling Israelis to do today?
Well, they had a very high, the highest state of alert in Israel. They had a clampdown and a closure of the West Bank, preventing people from moving around very much. And so I think there was just a sense that you should be on a heightened state of alert, and that they're working with the Palestinians wander around and come into Jerusalem, that's for sure.
Yeah, and there was no Israeli official at the funeral in Cairo. Has the Israeli government shown a sign of reaching out to the new Palestinian leadership?
The Prime Minister Sharon has basically said that there are going to be no gestures here. He's not looking to reach out to them, although in the end, it would surprise me if they didn't do something. But the fact of the matter is that Sharon and other Israeli officials have said, no, you've got a new Palestinian leadership, and they have to show us that they're serious about what we've laid out before and what we laid out for Arafat, that mm-hmm. there has to be a crackdown on Palestinian militant groups and a seizure of their weapons, and some sign that they're willing to tackle Palestinian terrorism before we're going to make any moves.
And John, I'm wondering, how are Israelis responding to some of the responses to Yasser Arafat's death that are coming in around the world? The French send-off when he traveled from Paris, and some of the tributes. I'm wondering if they're offended. I mean, this is a man, of course, reported to have sent terrorists to the Munich Olympics and to Israel.
Well, I think a lot of them are offended, frankly. I mean, there are many, many people here who believe that Yasser Arafat was a master terrorist, that he was responsible for the deaths of thousands of Israelis and other people. And, you know, I think one of the ways that manifested itself was the backlash against the proposal that the Palestinians had that he be buried in Jerusalem. You know, the Israeli officials told me that basically that was just a really hot-button issue here domestically, and that it was a very emotional issue, and that this was a guy who, you know, Israelis blamed for killing thousands of people and hundreds more in the recent suicide bombing campaign against Israelis, and that they were offended and that there was no way that that was going to be allowed to happen. Mm.
John Ward Anderson is Washington Post correspondent in Jerusalem. John, thanks for speaking to us.
Okay, Robin, thanks.
Among the prisoners being held by the U.S. at Guantanamo Bay are about 22 Chinese Muslims called Uyghurs, 12 of whom the U.S. has decided no longer pose a threat to security. The Chinese government has demanded they be returned to China to face terrorism charges there, but the U.S. is reluctant to return them to China, fearing they may be tortured or killed. So a stalemate results. And what to do with the Uyghurs is the question. Adam Wolf is an analyst for the Power and Interest News Report in Chicago. He joins us on the line. First, Adam, who exactly are the Uyghurs?
The Uyghurs are a Muslim Turkic-speaking people from the northwest region of China. It's called Xinjiang. And they have traditionally been opposed to Chinese control of the region.
And there have been some small uprisings. So the Chinese treat them as terrorists, but the U.S. traditionally has not.
That's correct, yes. Before September 11th, the U.S. had a fairly clear policy on the Xinjiang region in which the U.S. promoted human rights issues and agitated for greater autonomy for the Uyghur people in the region. Following September 11th, it became clear that there were some connections between small militant groups of Uyghurs and al-Qaeda and other related terrorist networks, yeah, which has complicated the U.S. position on the region.
What were some of those connections? I mean, obviously, these men who are in Guantanamo Bay were captured fighting alongside the Taliban. Was that one?
Yes. It's not exactly clear what the men who were captured were doing in Afghanistan. They may have been fighting alongside al-Qaeda, or they may have been there specifically for training purposes. There have been reports in the past that the Uyghur Muslims have gone to Afghanistan for training with al-Qaeda-related organizations and then gone back to the Xinjiang region to fight against China.
Yeah. So what happens now? I mean, it's sort of a stalemate.
Yeah, it's a complicated position that the U.S. is in right now because there are no countries willing to accept the Uyghur Muslims, although the U.S. has determined that they are no longer a threat to U.S. security interests. And the reason that no countries seem willing to accept the Uyghur prisoners is that China has said that economic ties will be threatened by any country that accepts the prisoners.
How big a threat are they? How many of them are there? Why is China so worried?
It's a very small number. This is more of a symbolic issue for China. The U.S. has captured approximately 22 Uyghur militants in Afghanistan, and they're looking to release about half of them. So wherever they go, it's not so much a strategic threat that China feels, but a symbolic one that would justify the Uyghur agitation against Chinese control in the Xinjiang region.
Mm-hmm. What happens to them now?
Well, clearly there's no simple solution for the U.S. They can't repatriate the detainees to China because they fear for their safety. If they were to return to China, it's clear that they may be tortured or killed. Now, the U.S. is unwilling to grant them asylum within the U.S. borders for security reasons. They've been in Guantanamo. They know the conditions, and they know they may have been privy to information that can't get out into the public. Now, there's a fourth solution would be for the U.N. to negotiate their release. But that also seems unlikely because the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is concerned that the UN involvement would threaten China's cooperation with North Korean refugees. It seems likely that the detainees will be sent to another prison, probably in Afghanistan, that operates under more clear Geneva Convention codes, and that may help to convince a third-party country to accept the detainees.
Well, Adam Wolf, again, an analyst with the Power and Interest News Report. Thank you for telling us about the Uyghurs.
Thank you very much.
still to come, a new look at a very old culture, the Marsh Arabs of southern Iraq. You're listening to Here and Now. Hey, the Red Sox have won the World Series. Okay, I know that was last month's news, but I just can't get used to it. And even though the baseball season is over, there is news in the world of sports. This weekend is the Major League Soccer Championship. And myself, I'm rooting for the Red Sox. No, I know that there are other teams playing. And joining us to talk about the world of soccer, host of NPR's Only a Game, Bill Littlefield. Bill, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Robin.
And I do know that this is a big weekend in soccer. Tell us about it.
Well, it's the championship game for Major League Soccer. DC United will play the Kansas City Wizards. DC United, winners of three previous championships, 96, 97, and 99. They were the first real good team in Major League Soccer. Some people would say the only real good team for the first few years. Kansas City won the championship in 2000. One of my favorite sort of subplots is Jaime Moreno, who played for DC United for those teams that won the three of the first four championships. Then he went and played for New York last year. Now he's back and at age 30 seems to be rejuvenated and led the league in assists and has been a big part of their success this season.
Well, if we are just tuning in, what else should we be looking for?
Well, I think one thing we should be looking for is a particularly clever T-shirt suggestion that my friend Greg Lallis came up with. Since we've got KCDC, he wants KCDC T-shirts with the old logo of AC/DC. I don't know whether we'll see those in the stands. We should be looking for a team that scores a lot of goals with DC and a team that's magnificently successful at preventing goals with Kansas City. Bob Gansler, the Kansas City coach, sort of started the season by saying, if we can keep the other team from scoring, we don't have to score too much, which sounds basic, but it's worked pretty well for them.
But you've been telling me it's been high scoring.
Yes. Well, you get DC United playing the Revolution in the semifinal last weekend, six goals, and they still couldn't decide it. They had to go to penalty shots. And Kansas City scored three goals in one postseason game, two in another. The other subplot that's interesting is Kansas City has succeeded without Preki, Tony Meola, Chris Klein for a long portion of the season. People around here have talked about the Revolution doing very well with a lot of injuries. Their injuries don't even compare to what Kansas City and Bob Gansler have had to overcome.
Right. Hey, tell me something. How healthy is the league?
I think it's very healthy, and I'll give you one sign of its health. The league and the players just announced that they had signed a new collective bargaining agreement that extends through the next several years, unlike the National Hockey League, which the last time I looked had locked out its players. So people often compare Major League Soccer with the National Hockey League, and they say, well, you know, the best soccer can hope for is to become sort of like hockey on the sports landscape. Hey, soccer's playing, hockey ain't.
And tell me, what's the Freddie Adu factor? Have I said that right?
Well, yeah, Freddie Adu is the kid who signed with DC United at the age of 15. He was, throughout this season, the single largest attendance boost factor that anybody had seen in Major League Soccer. Wherever United played, people poured into stadiums to see him play. He has not been anything like a Rookie of the Year or Most Valuable Player or anything like that, at least by my measure. But he has played very well, and he has learned the game as men play it gradually as the year has gone on, and there's every reason to think that he'll be a great player. He still is a marquee kind of draw just because he's a kid, and they've signed him, and he's held his own.
Well, all things do return to the Red Sox. And so just before we let you go, I want to say that, yes, the season's over, but sort of a shocker yesterday.
Well, the silly season has begun, and that is the season in which we begin to find out who'll be wearing the laundry next April. All of the Red Sox who were eligible to become free agents became free agents pretty much on schedule, and none of them have been re-signed. And so Mr. Veritek and his agent are apparently hoping that somebody will pay him a great deal more than the Red Sox seem inclined to do, and we'll have to wait and see.
There's Jason Veritek. There's also Pedro Martinez, the pitcher.
And there's Derek Lowe.
Is George Steinbrenner of the Yankees on the phone with them as we speak?
Well, I'm not sure he is directly on the phone, but I think it's fair to assume that there's a fair amount of activity going on, not just Mr. Steinbrenner. I mean, there's a lot of teams out there with a lot of money and a lot of teams that could use a solid catcher and a first-line pitcher. And for that matter, the Red Sox are going to need a shortstop, and Mr. Cabrera is also a free agent.
I have a Mitt. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. For 7,000 years, the Marsh Arabs lived on the waterways of southern Iraq. Their reed and mud huts floated on canals. They traveled by canoes, often with domesticated water buffaloes aboard. But for the past 50 years, their way of life has been slowly erased. The water drained, first by the British and then by Saddam Hussein. It was feared that by 2008, the wetlands and the Marsh Arabs would disappear entirely. But now, after the fall of Saddam, they're both making a comeback. What might a revitalized marshland look like? Well, to find out, we made a trip to the Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The Marsh Arabs were first introduced to many Westerners in 1934 by anthropologist Henry Field, and some of his photographs of that time were recently rediscovered and are part of an exhibit at the museum called The Marsh Arabs of Iraq, 1934. We spoke to the curator, Harvard doctoral student Omar Duwachi, who took us on a trip back in time.
The Marsh Arabs' its history is very significant in the West because of it's where supposedly the biblical site for the Garden of Eden and their archaeological link and history to the Sumerians.
Describe some of these photographs. When was this taken and what are we looking at? I can see all the water.
Yes, this is basically, it's always taken through 1934, in April of 1934. And it was taken by Henry Field, not the photographs, but it was an expedition led by Henry Field to the marshlands. And he was a physical anthropologist and archaeologist who was doing an anthropometric survey. So the collection contains these different genres of photography. So the first group that we are looking at right now is a kind of more of a landscape photography, looking at the Marsh Arabs and their kind of lifestyle. A lot of the pictures, people, and they're like going about their everyday. And this image, the first one, is kind of an interesting one. It shows you the reed huts, the villages that are built on these kind of islands of reed and mud.
What did you hear? You grew up in Baghdad. What did you hear of the Marsh Arabs when you were growing up?
The word for Marsh Arabs was the word ma'dan. People would tell me, would say the word ma'dan and the singular is ma'adi, always meant some kind of a culturally inferior or ignorant person. So it was a kind of a cultural slur. And then until I was in medical school that I encountered the Marsh area and the term as actually living people that exist, and that's the term that they use for to call them.
Huh. I mean, that's so funny that you wouldn't have known that was the real people.
Yes. When I came to the United States, which was 3 years ago, I encountered a different story of the marshes. The marshes were romanticized. They were always looked at, you know, by anthropology literature and travel literature as the quote-unquote noble savage, you know, the people who are resisting modernity. And for me, it was a kind of an interesting encounter to see that kind of other over there is actually romanticized in that way.
And we're looking at more pictures of them on these long, slender canoes, making, you know, navigating through, it's almost like the Venice of Iraq.
It is. And it's a fascinating, place. And the other thing about it, it was, plagued with a lot of diseases, malaria. And when the British came to Iraq in 1914, they were really interested in actually also cleaning up, in a way, the area and the draining up some of these marshes because they thought that it was a kind of a locus of disease and infections and malaria and endemic diseases.
Was that true? I mean that led to some of their characterization as sort of the sick, the maybe contagious. But was that true?
Well, it was definitely an area that had a high number of diseases, definitely. But there was this obsession with draining swamps and draining wetlands in that sense. There was a lot of projects in the 1950s supported by the Iraqi government at that time, contracting British engineers to actually drain part of the marshes for health and sanitation reasons.
Before we talk about the ultimate culmination of the draining of the swamps by Saddam Hussein, here are some portraits. Who are these people?
The main image that you see, the big sheikh holding this 8-gauge rifle in his hands and a cigarette holder, he's Sheikh Faleh al-Sayhud.
His circumference is huge because of all the blankets and robes that he's wearing. He has a head covering, a very proud bearing, a beard.
He was over 300 pounds. He was about 6 feet tall. And that time he was about 85 years old.
Really? He doesn't look that old.
Yeah, he doesn't look that old. He dyed his hair, his beard, actually, with henna, so he gives him kind of a younger look.
Henna. And this is all, you know, in the 30s. The final images are, they look like lineup pictures from, yes. You know, U.S. prisons.
That's what was really kind of disturbing and also caught my attention. So these images were taken for scientific reasons at that time. You can see the data sheets also next to them, which has the information, the physical characteristic information. So the thing that kind of grabbed my attention is the familiarity of these things to the present and the way we think about racial profiling in the present, especially of Middle Eastern men right now. So there is something that is very familiar about that science that, for me, I think till now is haunting us.
And these are pictures from the 30s, just
these
to clarify.
Pictures from the 30s, yeah, and they look like these mugshots. And you can see these men with their profiles and their front views with numbers on their jackets.
As you mentioned, politically, leaders in Iraq were always trying to drain the marshlands. And then in 1992, mm-hmm. Saddam Hussein mm-hmm. completely drained it mm-hmm. and turned it into a desert.
Yes, he basically established many dams that blocked the water from the marshland, and it was a way for him to, you know, punish people there. And of course, the story of the drainage became very important here in the West because of it's kind of was another story of the devastation of Saddam's regime.
It's interesting that the West would hold it up as an example of Saddam's cruelty, because I'm thinking that the story of the Marsh Arabs parallels the American Indian.
That's very interesting to have that comparison. I think there is this element of it. And, of course, right now there is a lot of international and national interest in restoring the marshes and providing some kind of ecologically sane environment for the Marsh Arabs to live.
Are there still Marsh Arabs who are ready to move back and live on the water?
Well, there's around 20,000 Marsh Arabs who returned to the marshes after the fall of Saddam's regime, and many of them broke the dams and they want to go back. But, you know, a lot of people think that this place has no infrastructure, has no schools, has no healthcare. So it's really uncertain of what really going to come out of it. The danger, of course, of having such a kind of a restoration is that it could become a kind of a tourist trap or, you know, come and have a look at the Marsh Arabs. And, you know, that's the kind of the danger of all of that.
Omar, thank you so much. And one last question. Are you going to go there?
Hopefully one day. I don't think very soon, but hopefully one day I definitely would love to visit.
Omar, thank you.
You're welcome.
Omar Douachi is curator of the exhibit The Marsh Arabs of Iraq, 1934. The photographs are now on view at the Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. For more, check out our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Stefano Katsonis, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, and Karen Miller-Medson. Sorry, Karen. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Will Thompson. Our newscast producer is Lindsay Crudell. And our interns are John McAvoy, Danielle Dreilinger, and Jen Miller. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Thank goodness it's Friday. Join us again here and now.
For
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.